good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line E. Michael Jones. We're going to be talking about his book, The Slaughter of Cities, Urban Renewal and as Ethnic Cleansing. Thank you so very much for being with us today. Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Okay, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Can you tell our listeners yourself?
I received a Ph.D. in American University in 1979. Then I started a magazine called Fidelity in 81, and that changed to Culture Wars in 95. And in the meantime, I've done about 11 books.
Well, of course, this is a phenomenal book. I mean, this is well over 600 pages on urban renewal. And, of course, that doesn't sound like very exciting. And yet, as you begin to develop this whole story, we begin agendas here. And this is really what we want to talk about today, and about how whenever government begins to interfere in the affairs of men, it creates a problem. And certainly I saw this when I was a physician. When I practiced medicine, there wasn't a problem as far as availability of health care. I mean, you went to the hospital, you got great care, you got a back rub, were you taken care of, you rang the bell, somebody came. Today you go to the hospital, you got more of a chance of winning the lottery than you have of getting a back rub. And just try to get anybody in the middle of the night when everybody's so busy doing the paperwork required by the government. Costs are out of control. The cost of health care has gone up 30 or 40% the last year or two. And it all gets right back to the fact that government interfered in the marketplace and changed the whole concepts of the health care delivery. But they've done the same thing as far as housing, haven't they, too?
Yeah, what we're talking about is social engineering. The government got involved in social engineering in the late 30s and defeated all of its opponents at the time of Pearl Harbor, and expanded it ever since that time.
And, of course, this is the idea that the planners know what's best, how to rebuild our cities. And you make, they tear down houses. They never build as many new ones as they did before. And many times the houses they build end up being slums. So why don't you just sort of develop this whole incredible story as you give us the history of Chicago and Philadelphia.
To take a city like Philadelphia, there was a kind of compact that was made between the Irish Catholics and the WASP ruling class, where if the Catholics were Irish, would give up their inclination to violent revolution and stop joining organizations like the Molly Malones and things like that, they would give it. And that worked out very well. The housing in Philadelphia was cheap enough so that it was called a row house, their own houses in Philadelphia. But then as in the run-up to World War II, this agreement was unilaterally abrogated. And what happened was that the government just decided that they were going to tell people how to live, and if people didn't like it, to say about it.
But, of course, behind this establishment, there were already these social planners, these followers of and, of course, Bertrand Russell, these socialists who thought that they know what was best for us, common folks. We'll be back here in just a moment with E. Michael Jones to talk about his great book. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest today is E. Michael Jones. His book is The Slaughter of Cities, Urban Renewal as Ethnic Cleansing. And he basically takes a number of the great cities of America, Philadelphia, Chicago, other cities, and, of course, shows how these four cities, each one of them, of course, was really blighted by government projects supposedly aimed at doing away with blight and how urban development was going to make for better cities. And how did it really end up?
You can't discuss it without discussing World War II.
All right, fine. Well, do you pick up the story then?
Basically, there was a group of people in this country that wanted America into World War II. They wanted America in on the side of England. They defeated the America First, sort of the Midwest isolationist. And once the war began, once America was in the war, then they had a big problem. First problem is there's a huge labor shortage. All these men are now becoming soldiers, and we have to increase production at the same time we have a labor shortage. So basically, source of untapped labor in the United States, and that's basically the Negro sharecropper down south. So you got to bring him up north. That's the first issue. Second issue, and I'm talking now from the point of view of sociologist Louis Wirth at the University of Chicago, the Rusty, and the psychological warfare establishment, the people that wrote Gunnar Myrdal's book, The American Dilemma, about race. Second problem, according to these people, is that certain people are, in worse words, suspect because of their origin. Now, the first group is going to be the Germans, then the Italians, but it turns out that there's a whole list of people, and it's basically all these Catholic European ethnics, or all the Poles, for example. Why are the Poles on this list? When Germany invaded Poland in 1939, but they're on the list, okay? And so what we have here is basically a plan to kill with one stone, okay? You got to bring the Negro sharecroppers up north. Once you get them up north, where are you going to put them? Detroit had 250,000 people come within a six-month period. Where are you going to put them? Well, you're going to put them in those ethnic neighborhoods and break up the neighborhoods because you can't trust those people. And that basically was the beginning of the whole urban renewal as ethnic cleansing.
And basically, of course, they didn't trust the Germans. There were German neighborhoods there. There were Polish neighborhoods there. And they were going to do away with all of these neighborhoods as part of these government programs doing away with blight. And so we're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, E. Michael Jones, his book, The Slaughter of Cities: Urban Renewal as Ethnic Cleansing. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest, E. Michael Jones. We're talking about his book. We're talking about how these major cities and in cities like Philadelphia and Detroit, the Second World War comes along. They've got to get, of course, a lot of workers, and so they begin bringing a large numbers of blacks from the South, and they just sort of dump them into the cities. And you were saying, what, about a quarter of a million? How many there in a six-month period in Detroit?
In Detroit, yeah, a huge influx, and basically no place to go, no housing, no adequate housing for them, and a lot of tension because they're bringing up people from all over the place. A lot of people from Kentucky as well went to Detroit to work in the auto factories, and this is a group, both uprooted people, and they can't fighting over housing, and finally it breaks out in the open. There's a riot in 1942, one of the most the biggest race riots in the history of the United States. So, all these people flowing into cities that have no capacity to keep them, to house them.
So what happens?
What happens is the government decides that it's going to start building housing. And so they, basically during the war had priority over pretty much everything. There was a war to win, but that was a fairly short period of time. I mean, by the time the war got, everybody woke up to the fact that we were at war, it was 1942, and it was over in 45, so it's a very quick mobilization. What happened is that those policies were then continued after the war under the same premises. Now, suddenly the rules of the game have changed. Suddenly, we're not at war with those countries. Those people happen to be American citizens with all the rights of American citizens, no matter what country they came from, whether it's Germany or Italy or Poland, they're American citizens. So, but the policy of, changing the man by changing the environment, which was sort of the credo of the social engineers, continued. Now it's consolidated. All those groups are consolidated as basically Catholics. That's the way they're viewed, and they are viewed as a political threat largely because of their birth rate.
All right, and of course, then they're threatening the Protestant majority, but they're really threatening the sort of the elite that's really running things behind the scenes. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, there was a WASP elite at this time. There's no question about it. I mean, you know, and there were people who spoke for the WASP elite, and one of them who spoke eloquently was Paul Blanchard. He wrote a book in 1947 called American Freedom and Catholic Power, and it basically portrayed the Catholics as a threat to American democracy. Because, you know, all the old stuff, they take orders from Rome, but beneath it all was the demographic threat. They're having too many children. Paul Blanchard was a friend of Margaret Sanger. He was a sexual liberationist, and you began to see this kind of decadent WASP ruling class coalescing around these values and viewing the Catholics as a threat, and then, it basically at the height of their power, deciding to do something. And what they decided to do was break up these ethnic neighborhoods.
And this was a part of this process then of urban renewal.
Well, that's when urban renewal got started. It was basically after the war that it got started. And so basically these, like the Quaker WASP, the ruling class in Philadelphia, was always involved in housing. But now they had federal government behind, federal money behind what they were doing. I mean, before they were worried about you know, like the Italian neighborhood in South Philadelphia, they had pigsties in their backyards, and so it smelled bad, and they would try and deal with that. Well, now we're dealing with a massive influx of money, and also this sense of WASP purpose. They had won their crusade against fascism, and now they're going to do something about the cities. Now, the cities, you know, nothing pretty much had happened in the cities since 1929. You had a depression. Then you had the war, and so there was a problem. You know, there was nothing had been built, and so under that guise, they decided, we're going to change everything. We're going to change the people. And so you had the beginning of this thing, like the ethnic cleansing of the West End in Boston was one of the first examples and the most outrageous examples of what I'm talking about. Herbert Gans wrote a book about this called The Urban Villagers, in which Herbert Gans lived in the West End, and he worked for the housing authority. So he saw both sides of the issue, and he says very, very clearly in his book, it wasn't the housing, it wasn't the state of the housing, it was the ethnicity of the inhabitants. These were mostly Italians, and the social workers felt, well, we're going to socialize them, we're going to integrate them, we're going to Americanize them, and we're going to bust up the neighborhood. And the fact of the matter was that it was a valuable piece of real estate, and that just added to the, you know, the incentive to do this.
And, of course, they had to, of course, say, oh, it's blighted. That's the reason we're going to go in. We're here, of course, we're from the government. We're here to help. We've got to do away with this blighted area. But there were lots more blighted areas than many times the ones they chose, weren't there?
Well, I mean, as I said, what do you mean by blight? As I said, nothing much had happened since 1929 because there was no money around to do anything. But the other thing is, in Philadelphia, for example, there was housing that was built for poor people, which doesn't exist anymore. There is no housing built for poor people. There were row houses where you had one room on the first floor, one room on the second, and one room on the third. Okay, they were called Father, Son, Holy Ghost houses, or, you know, a number of different names for them. These were houses that were built for poor people. They were inexpensive housing. That's another word for blight in these people's minds. Okay, they come in, they destroy these houses, okay, but you just destroyed affordable housing. We're talking about $30 a month. This is my mother... My mother lived on a big street in Philadelphia, a big house on a big street, and her family paid $30 a month, and the people behind couldn't afford that. They paid $15 a month. Now that's affordable housing. Okay? They come in, they declare it blighted, and they destroy the whole thing. And it begins, after a while, you look at the map, okay? The map of Philadelphia, Philadelphia Housing Authority, the archives. This is a map of what they're going to tear down. Well, they're going to tear down basically every old house in Philadelphia, entire sections of the area. Of course, they were all the Catholic areas. You go up to, that's pretty much the center core. Then you go up, and suddenly there's this big chunk up there in the northeast that they're going to tear down too. That's Bridesburg. Now, Bridesburg, I've been there. It's the same houses as 50 years ago, and they're not blighted now. That means they were not blighted 50 years ago.
But, you know, the thing is that after the Second World War, the government had all this money. In fact, the people had got used to paying their income taxes because we had to defeat the wicked Germans and the wicked Japanese. And then after the Second World War, we had the Cold War, and we had the wicked communists were threatening us. So the people are paying their taxes. And, of course, we've expanded massively the power of government. And now government has the money for all of these projects. And without that money for the projects, would these things have ever taken place?
No. I mean, another word is a massive centralization of power in Washington. And we're seeing it right now. What is the main excuse for centralization of power? It's always war.
Right. Of course, there's wicked Osama bin Laden that, of course, when we sent our troops into Afghanistan, they weren't allowed to go after him. In fact, anybody who doubts that, we have an article out of the Washington Times. We'll be glad to send you a copy, where high government officials said, we're not trying to get Osama bin Laden. Our policy is not Osama bin Laden first. Our policy is Osama bin Laden last, because if we got Osama bin Laden, how could we justify this war in Afghanistan? If you'd like a copy of that, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or get Paul Sperry's wonderful book, Crude Politics. But let's get back to, first, we're in the Second World War. The Second World War is over. And now, because we have the threat of communism, we've got the Iron Curtain, now the government has to have all this money. And, of course, supposedly it's to defend us from communism. And yet, of course, it's being used ready to take away our freedom, isn't it?
It was used as an instrument in intra-ethnic warfare in America. And basically, I mean, the theory that makes the most sense about ethnicity in America is the thing that is called the triple melting pot. That basically, after the third generation in America, country of origin ceases to be the ethnic designator, and religion becomes the ethnic designator in America. And so it's Protestant, Catholic, Jew is the triple melting pot. Well, you had a war between these three groups. And to look at it as black and white or racial is just to miss the whole point. It wasn't, you know, white against black. It was one group of whites using the blacks as sort of stormtroopers against another group whose demographic increase was threatening their political power.
All right, fine. And so then, of course, what they do is they target these specific areas, not that they're blighted at all, but that they want to break them up so they'll no longer be a political force. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much. And there's a lot of bewilderment on the part of, for example, the people in Corktown in Detroit in the 1950s. You know, well, what do you mean by blight? Well, the government can't be honest with you, because blight is not the reason that Corktown has to be destroyed. The main reason at that point, I mean, it wasn't really an Irish neighborhood by that point, but it was a Maltese neighborhood. But Corktown had to go because they need trucking terminals, because the urban renewal where the trucking terminals was destroyed all of that infrastructure. So it's got to go someplace else. Well, they can't say this. The government officials can't be honest about this whole thing, and so they have to come up with this specious blight, you know, which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because, you know, once you get the reputation of blight, then the bankers won't lend you any money to fix up your house. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And, of course, then the value of property goes down, and they kind of come in, they're going to buy the property at, 50 or 40 or 30% of what it was worth. And you've had a perfectly good house, they pay you off, and now you don't have enough money to buy another house.
Yeah.
And, of course, this was a story that comes over and over and over again. And as you point out, of course, there's certainly the Irish were willing to leave. The Poles weren't. We can cover that when we get back here with our special guest, E. Michael Jones. His book, The Slaughter of Cities, a fascinating reading to see what bureaucrats and what these idealists can do to destroy a society. Set genocide, and one of the tapes is an interview with a Dr. Dinigan, who heard back in 1969 actually a talk given by Dr. Day, who would later become the president
of Planned Parenthood. And Dr. Day laid out the whole plan for America, the fact there are too many people, the fact that we're going to have to create new diseases, the fact that we're going to have to conceal some of the very obvious treatments for cancer, because people are going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. An incredible interview, and a series of other interviews that will go into the background of what is happening in America, why new diseases are cropping up all the time. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of our 4-tape set, Genocide. It's vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. America, our values, our future are under attack today.
This is radio health journalist Bill Sardi. Hey, a lot of smart supplement users like to check out the facts before they purchase an herbal product. So go to www.lifespannnutrition.com and read all about Alamax, the new odorless, 100% pure Allicin garlic extract imported from Great Britain. You'll find Alamax is equivalent to 15 cloves of fresh crushed garlic. Check it out at www.lifespannnutrition.com or call 866-405-4000 to learn more about this breakthrough in garlic technology called Alamax. Call 1-866-405-4000 today.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I want to remind our listeners that we've now put our evening program, which goes from 8 to 10 here in the Pacific Coast, and of course that's 11 to 1 in the morning. Back on the East Coast, that's pretty late, but 8 to 10 is a great time. But this is now on shortwave, because so many of our listeners on the West Coast just couldn't get the evening programs. So it is available on shortwave on the same station we're on now, 5.745 megahertz. Now, if you don't have a shortwave set, we carry a very good one. It's called the Sanjian 505, and it comes with a carrying case, and it's digital, and it's got all the things you need. Got a little 24-foot retractable aerial antenna. Of course, antennas are the secret to getting good shortwave reception. If you want to get a longer one, you can get it down at Radio Shack for about $10. But if you're interested in knowing more about the Sanjian 505, which I think is the best deal, I think they're ordinarily about $179.95. We're offering them for $149.95 plus shipping. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR to find out about the Sanjian 505 shortwave receiver. Now, why is this important? Why? Because we need to be able to reach as many people as we can. And a shortwave and the internet are the two most efficient means of doing it. Buying radio time really becomes prohibitively expensive. So we ask you to tell others about our shortwave program. That's 8 to 10 every evening at 5.745 megahertz, the same shortwave station we're using. But of course, right now we're on a number of other stations as well, probably in areas where they're not going to be able to get our evening program. And now you can. You can get it on shortwave. Get yourself a shortwave receiver. And of course, tell others about our programs, because the only way we're possibly going to be able to keep America free is to get the facts to the American people. Most people, as I pointed out last hour, most people are good Americans who love this country and love freedom. Let's try to preserve it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is E. Michael Jones. His book, The Slaughter of Cities, Urban Renewal as Ethnic Cleansing. And, of course, after the Second World War, now, of course, our perceptions begin to change. We're looking more to government to solve us. After all, we've got the wicked communists there. They're a threat to us. And so we've got to look to our government. And, of course, they're putting a lot of money initially in the military. As time goes by, they cut back on the military. And they spend more money on all of these government socialist programs aimed at controlling the individual. So you want to pick up the story from there?
Well, the story breaks down to individual cities.
Go ahead.
Each individual city was asked to create its own housing authority under the New Deal, and basically those elites there who had been involved in housing before the New Deal then simply took over these bodies, but now had a lot more financial firepower behind them. They also had sort of the spirit of the times behind them, because everybody believed in planning now. Everybody believed in science and things like that. And so Philadelphia in 1947. They have the Better Philadelphia exhibit, which is a huge model of what a Bauhaus Philadelphia is going to look like. And people, it was a huge sort of propaganda campaign. School children were asked what they would do to redesign their neighborhoods, the assumption being, of course, that somebody's going to tear down their neighborhood, you know what I mean? Get them used to that idea. And also, at a certain point, both of the parts of social engineering that grew up out of Gunnar Myrdal's book, The American Dilemma, were challenged in the courts. And in 1954, both of these programs of social engineering were ratified by the Supreme Court.
Now, this was really an example of judicial activism having nothing to do with the Constitution, but just the idea that the judicial activists on our Supreme Court had an agenda, and that was they were going to pursue this this sort of socialist programming, this this command control of the individual.
Well, yeah, one of the leading figures was William O. Douglas on the court at that time. And the court basically ratified both of these ideas. In one decision was Brown versus School Board, which was the school desegregation building, which basically turned the schools into a form of a much more virulent form of social engineering and injected race into the whole thing. But a lesser known decision at that time was Berman versus Parker. Same year, the decisions came down about 6 months apart. And Berman versus Parker was basically a suit brought by a man who owned a clothing store in Washington, D.C., whose building, he said, well, building, nothing wrong with the building. They testified that it was established in court testimony. There was nothing blighted about his building. But the government insisted that it be torn down. And he said, no, why should it be torn down? If the neighborhood's going to be revitalized, I want to be here and sell clothing to those people. You know, it makes sense. Well, you read William O. Douglas's opinion in there, and it's basically, if the government has a plan, the plan takes precedent over your right to property. It's that simple.
And, of course, the property right was one of the fundamentals of all of our individual freedom. Without property rights, there is no individual freedom or liberty.
Right. And so what happened here is eminent domain got expanded beyond all proportion. If the government, basically, Berman versus Parker says, if the government has a plan, they can take your property.
And, of course, then they'll fight you and they'll get it just as cheaply as possible. Then you may own your home, you may own your business. They take it away, they give you a paltry sum of money, and you are impoverished. You can't buy something similar. And then, of course, you've destroyed the lives of so many people by doing this. And this seems to be a pattern not only then, but even to this very day.
Well, they have these so-called quick take laws now. The most grievous example in the book is basically about 30 years after that, the destruction of Poll Town neighborhood in Detroit, which was a collaborative effort between General Motors and the city of Detroit. The mayor of the city of Detroit was Coleman Young at that point. The blacks had taken over Detroit, and Coleman Young pursued a policy of basically driving whites out of the city.
And that, of course, would solidify his political base. Then.
Yeah, I mean, basically, he solidified his base by giving cheap housing to his supporters.
Sure.
If the people abandon the city en masse, the prices are going to collapse, and then you've got basically cheap housing. And so what you had in Detroit was what I call slash-and-burn housing. They get cheap housing, they live in it, they run it into the ground, then move on to the next new house.
All right, we're going to be back here. And you only have to go into many of these cities, Detroit, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia today, to see large areas really totally uninhabited because of these policies we're talking about.
Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war. Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our four-tape set, Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I just want to mention that we carry something called Phonopoly, and it's a program that's designed to teach you or your children, your grandchildren, how to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. And it's designed by Myrta Culbreth, who built up the phonics game, and now she has something called Phonopoly. It's played very much like Monopoly. It's a fun game to play, but in the process, you learn the 40 sounds of the English language, the 12 basic rules, and in 16 hours, you can undo all the harm that has been done on your mind and the minds of your children, deliberately dumbing them down as far as our educational system is concerned. So most of these programs are $300, $400, $500, $600. Phonopoly is $139.95. And if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, you can get it. And I think that you'll find that this is a wonderful way to teach children how to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. It's worked for many children. It'll work for yours. And then, of course, we also carry something called Miracle 2 products, Miracle 2 soap products, and we can't make any medical claims for them. We can tell you lots of people use them and tell us that they help their rashes and they help their acne and they help their upper and lower gastrointestinal tract symptoms. And the manufacturer makes all sorts of claims. We don't make any claims other than tell you it's excellent soap. I've used the moisturizing soap because I had a rash on my forehead, and that really has taken care of that. Certainly my wife uses the moisturizing soap on her hair, thinks it does a wonderful job. It takes the neutralizer because it cuts down tremendously on her necessity for expensive pills for her heartburn. And we hear this sort of story from so many people. Why not give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and order the soap, the moisturizing soap, the lotion, the gel, and the neutralizer. Get them all right now. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is E. Michael Jones. We're talking about his book, The Slaughter of Cities, going into the background of the urban renewal programs, which were usually used for ethnic cleansing, to break up racial groups so they would not have any political clout in cities, using government money for these projects. And, well, it destroyed an awful lot of lives, an awful lot of homes, an awful lot of staid neighborhoods that were not blighted at all. And it was all done for political purposes, totally ignoring our constitutional guarantee of property rights, our right to life, liberty, and property. And, of course, that's with the Lockean concepts. You will never see the words life and liberty mentioned in the Constitution without seeing associated with that the use of the word property. But of course, the Marxists and the socialists and the planners don't believe you have any property rights. They believe that they know what's best for you. So our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. If you have a question for Mr. Jones, and he's done an amazing job in over 600 pages of chronicling what happened in these various cities. So which city do you want to pick up there?
Well, the city I think that fared the best under this regime was Chicago. And I think it was largely because Mayor Daley, the father of the current Mayor Daley, just took control of the whole racial migration and government intervention, these two things happening simultaneously. Chicago was one of the main destinations for the blacks down south. They came up on the Chicago, the Illinois Central. There's a statue now where the old Illinois Central station used to be of a black man with his cardboard suitcase and a rope tied around it. to get off the train and then walk down south, down State Street, and find a cheap place, and then so on and so forth. The rest, you know, inhabiting the south side. Huge influx of people. And Chicago fared well because they basically, Daley took the money and he built what you would call high-rise ghettos. He took the created projects and he concentrated the newcomers in these places like the Robert Taylor home just south of IIT, the Illinois Institute of Technology.
All right. Well, what about the other cities? Where did the people go when they took away their homes? In other words, they lost their homes. They didn't have enough money to replace them. So what happened to them? What happened?
They went to the suburbs.
They went to the suburbs.
The suburbs were the place for where white people were supposed to go. That was the plan.
And this was really all planned then to more or less centralize the blacks in the inner city?
The blacks, the cities were turned over to the blacks. The suburbs were where the white people were supposed to go. That was the plan. Levittown was created in 1947. Levittown was war worker housing. The Levitt brothers learned how to build housing working for the Seabees in the Pacific. They learned how to pour 100 foundations a day and build, you know, slab houses. The purpose, if you read William H. White's book, The Organization Man, White spent a lot of time analyzing suburbs. He spent time in Park Forest outside of Chicago, and he spent time in Drexel Hill outside of Philadelphia. And basically, you see the purpose of the suburbs. The white people were, or let's put it this way, the Poles became white people. The ethnics de-ethnicized. They were they were sent into these homogeneous suburbs where they're supposed to be the pool for the modern American corporation, which was national in scope, and so therefore you were had to be willing to be shipped all over the country. It was the end of your affiliation with any one place. And the suburbs were basically identical, just as the corporate branches were identical, and that was this mobile workforce, and that's where there's new de-ethnicized white people were supposed to live.
But then what about the blacks in the inner city? Did they have jobs, or where were they going to get jobs?
They had jobs at the whim of the ruling class.
Okay.
I mean, basically, they had jobs when they needed jobs. But, I mean, you see, we were at the beginning now of the whole globalization process. The globalization process began in America by shipping jobs out of cities. So, for example, you know, Philadelphia got rich on textiles. The manufacturers made clothing for the soldiers during the Civil War and became very wealthy, and so became a textile area. And that continued with each war. Same thing happened with each war. Now, after World War II, the people working in the textile mills, they started to unionize. They wanted better wages. Well, what happened then? The textile mills closed down, and they moved to Louisiana. And that began the process that we are now witnessing, where as soon as workers organize and they want a higher wage, the company closes down and moves to some place where the wages are cheaper.
Oh, no, it's over to Malaysia or over to China. Well, let's got Ben who's calling from Salinas. Ben, do you have a question for our...
I have two brief questions.
Okay.
The first one is, do you, sir, believe that there are, in truth, two Americas, one for the wealthy elite and one for the rest of us?
All right. Do you get the question, Mike?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of looking at the situation.
Okay, now my second question is this. In light of the $1.2 trillion tax gift to the wealthy elite, how can they justify the elite getting such a tax break while the other 90% of us get the bill, $565 billion, not including the cost of prosecuting this war, and $1.2 trillion tax break to the wealthy? How can they justify this, and why are not people in the streets?
All right. Thanks very much.
The wealthy control the government. I think it's pretty clear. And why aren't people in the streets? There's a very simple answer to that. They're watching television. In other words, the history of this post-World War II period is one form after the other of sophisticated social and political control.
Well, it's very, very hard for a lot of people to believe that we really have a ruling elite. But the reality is we really do. And these people move in certain circles, and we call them the Council on Foreign Relations, which interlocks with the corporate elite. And these are the people who go to the international conferences, the people dedicated to globalization. And of course, their real purpose, the real loyalty is not to America, but this globalist dream. And really goes back, their philosophy goes back to that of Plato, who believed in a ruling oligarchy and everybody else subjected to government control and monitoring. And that's exactly what's happening today. This sounds like what the Marxist says. Unfortunately, it's true. So go ahead.
I think the WASP ruling class came into existence after the Civil War, a national ruling class who imposed its values on the rest of the country. And that it was ethnically homogeneous up until recently. I'd say, you know, when did the WASP ruling class end? 1978, John D. Rockefeller and Nelson Rockefeller died, so that was significant. Catherine Hepburn died. You can name it, but there was a time when this was an ethnically homogeneous group that had certain values in common, and they imposed them on the rest of the nation. And the culmination of their hegemony, I think, was the urban renewal, the housing campaign.
All right, of course, they've had many, many projects. Certainly, they've taken over control of our educational system, and that is covered beautifully in a book called Foundations, Their Power and Influence, showing how they've rewritten the textbooks, they've rewritten the encyclopedias. They had the part written on socialism, written by a socialist, the part written on communism, written by a communist, the part written by on capitalism, written by a communist. So why would they do that? Are these communists? Oh, communism is basically simply a power structure with a small group of people controlling the masses. Stripped of all the idealism, stripped of all the theories of Karl Marx, that is what socialism and communism are really all about.
Well, during this period of time, if you go, like the Carnegie Foundation asked Gunnar Myrdal to write the book, The American Dilemma, about race. Alger Hiss was the head of the Carnegie Foundation. He was a communist. There's no question about it. He was a communist spy. Okay, the people who wrote it were the psychological warfare establishment. Louis Wirth was a communist. He was an admirer of Stalin. He got his idea of ethnic cleansing by reading Stalin. Now, this situation changed in 1946. The ADA was found, Americans for Democratic Action, when this group of people, sort of the American, the Enlightenment in America, broke with the communists. And so after that, it had its own separate trajectory, and it's you have to take this into account as well. But the theory, the idea of central planning, or planning, having a plan that takes precedent over people's property rights, is an intrinsically Marxist and communist idea. There's no question about it.
And of course, this basically was what was brought into America following the Second World War. And of course, this book covers what happened in Boston, what happened in Chicago, what happened in Detroit, and what happened in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia has still not gotten over all the racial problems there, has it?
Philadelphia is basically on its way to becoming a black city, just like Detroit. It's just the plan is going to follow its natural trajectory. I think that's what's going to happen in Detroit.
Well, it's
so to say there's racial conflict. I don't think there is much racial conflict anymore because it's a monoracial city, pretty much. Except, again, the pattern is pretty much the same. There is a kind of elite group that lives around the center of town. Society Hill in Philadelphia was created for the nomenclatura in Philadelphia. Lafayette Park is that in Detroit. But outside of that, the neighborhoods are pretty much all gutted, blighted. They were even proposing at one point building a golf course in North Philadelphia. I mean, think of what that means.
Well, you point out in your book how they're just, blocks and blocks and blocks of just these empty buildings today, the end result of this whole shift that has occurred in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question that the people who were living in Southwest Philadelphia in parishes like Most Blessed Sacrament are all living in Delaware County now.
And, of course, the other tragedy is that many of these big housing developments that they built, because they were from the government and they were to help the people, soon became slums and people moved out of them. They wouldn't take care of them. There was no pride of ownership. And so all these housing projects, either they are the centers of distribution of drugs and crime, or they're simply abandoned.
Yeah, I held a press conference. I did a book, a biography of Cardinal Kroll, in 1995, and I held a press conference on the Schuylkill Expressway, and behind me there was the Schuylkill Falls Housing Project, which was a high-rise, 13-story building, classic Bauhaus. It was designed by Oskar Stoneroff, who was a Philadelphia resident and a student of Walter Gropius, the inventor of the Bauhaus Wohnmaschine. I held it there, and I said that this is a monument to a failed regime, because as of then, it had been empty for 20 years. And every day, hundreds of thousands of cars passed by this empty building. You know, no lights on, no one's living there. Well, you know, and then I said, and they're going to blow it up. At this point, the reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer says, that's not true. We have the head of the Philadelphia Housing Authority over in that car over there in the parking lot, and she said they're not going to blow it up. So I said, well, okay, if she said it, then she told me something different, because they told me they were going to blow it up. Even if they're not going to blow it up, it makes my point even more, because what I'm saying is it's a monument. A monument has to stand there to be a monument, right? So it's a monument because it's empty. Well, the next day they write an article, and the story is basically, Hick from Indiana doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, the fact is I grew up in Philadelphia. I'm a native of Philadelphia. So, but then the really good part is, 6 weeks after that, they blew it up. And there's no article about, you know, Hick from Indiana did know what he was talking about.
Well, that old adage, you can tell when a politician is lying because their lips are moving. You know, but your book really reiterates what I've often thought, and that is there's no problem facing the American people today that a new series of government regulations and programs won't make worse. I mean, the genius of America is the individual working and doing things, you know, and improving himself, and as a byproduct, improving society. But when you give government power, that power will be misused and create all the problems you're talking about.
Well, I have a slightly different take on this. I think that the genius of America was allowing ethnic groups to come over here and live in peace.
Right.
In other words, ethnic pluralism was the genius of America. It wasn't always smooth. I mean, there were conflicts here. But basically, this is completely compatible with the idea of the state having its own government, and there's not a central government controlling everything. The autonomy of the local community is essential to a healthy civilization. You can't have people from the top making all these decisions all the time. And when you do, what you have is a result that you look around at those big cities. That's going to be the result when all these people decide to just break up these ethnic communities and make everybody into one kind of person, one generic American, all 260 million of us. Doesn't matter whether you live in Los Angeles or Wheeling, West Virginia, we're all, that doesn't work. That's not going to work. And that was not the original plan of America, and that's sort of what this book is about.
All right, fine. We've got Nathan on the line. Nathan, we're almost out of time. Do you have a quick question?
Well, listen, this has been a great program, and I just have a quick question. What do you make of the argument that, you know, this put forward by some people that the inequalities of society are quote-unquote natural? I mean, you don't hear that so much these days. We used to hear it back in the 18th and 19th century. I don't believe it, but I just want to hear how you would respond to the notion that some people, quote, should, end quote, control all this wealth. And I'll leave my answer off the air.
Thank all right. How would you respond then to Nathan?
No, I think that wealth has a natural tendency to congeal in bigger and bigger amounts in fewer and fewer hands, and it will destroy society when it does.
It really does. And, of course, when you have a system like we have today, a Federal Reserve system with a fiat money system, where you can have bankers create money out of nothing and then use it to buy up the media or buy up the corporations or buy up the factories and take that money overseas, we have a totally fallacious system that I personally believe is on the verge of collapse. I think we're in real trouble because none of these systems have ever worked for any period of time. It's been tried many times in the past and always failed, and I think this one's going to fail. We're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners today?
I think we have to understand what it means to live in a local community once again. That we're not, that this centralization is a form of control, and it's not in our interest.
I agree with you totally. How can people get your book?
CultureWars.com on the web. You can order it through there. Or 574-289-9786.
One more time.
574-289-9786 or culturewars.com on the web.
All right, fine. It's a fascinating read. The Slaughter of Cities, culturewars.com. Thank you very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, a little different type of article, but this is a tremendous amount of history in Mr. Jones' book. We recommend it to you.
Well, we have a brand new video today on the Oklahoma City bombing. It's called Oklahoma, What Really Happened. And of course, it consists of a lot of never-before-seen video footage. Now, it was seen in Oklahoma City immediately following the bombing of the Murrah Building, but blacked out across America. And in this footage, you're going to see the commentators talking about the other bombs that were in the building at the time of the initial bombing. We're told, of course, that Timothy McVeigh acted independently. We're told many things by the media, but wherein does the truth lie? Oklahoma City, What Really Happened, it will give you the opportunity to see long suppressed video footage of what really transpired. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for Oklahoma City, What Really Happened.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. The title of the video we were speaking of was The Cover-Up in Oklahoma City. That's Cover-Up in Oklahoma City. It gives you a tremendous understanding of what really happened in Oklahoma City and the fact that we've never really gotten the truth. In fact, there's so much, so many similarities between what happened there at the bombing of the Murrah Building and what happened on September 11th of the year 2001. And, of course, if you really believe that Timothy McVeigh was the lone gunman, you really should read the book that he supposedly authored with a couple of reporters. And he describes driving through the street, through the streets of Oklahoma City. And he's got these fuses that he's got on this massive bomb. So he lights one 5 minutes from the where he's going to be leaving it off in front of the Murrah Building. What happens if there's a traffic jam? He never stops and thinks, what do you do? You've got this fuse lit and there's nothing you can do to stop it. Then he's got another fuse he lights just 1 minute away when he's when he's at the stoplight. And then, of course, he's got to get over. He's got to find a parking place in front of the building. What happens if there's no parking place in front of the building? But luckily, there was a parking place in front of the building. Actually, there were a couple of people in blue running suits from the Near East who were holding it for him. And these stories were attested to by so many people. He jumps, he goes in there, and then he slowly walks away. Now, it's obviously the bomb has already gone off if this was a one-minute fuse. He walks slowly a good distance, a couple of blocks, and then the explosion goes off. If you believe the stories you've heard, why, you probably believe you're going to win the lottery here next week. You need to get the material, Cover-Up in Oklahoma City, a fascinating insight into what really happened at Oklahoma City. And you can't understand what happened on September 11th unless you understand what happened at Oklahoma City. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will decide that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. And as we pointed out, our afternoon program, pardon me, our evening program is now heard on shortwave as well as the regular outlets we've had. So if you don't have a shortwave set and would like to hear that evening program, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And learn about the Sanzian shortwave receiver, which we're carrying. We think it's an excellent buy. Check out the various prices if you'd like, and if you decide you'd like to get the Sanzian, why, we'd be glad to help you get one. And then, of course, we want you to tell other people about our evening shortwave programs and get them working. That's from 8 to 10 the Pacific time. That's 10 to 12 Central time in the evening, and, of course, 11 to 1 in the morning on Eastern time. But the biggest problem we have now is the media. The people with the wealth have bought up most of the media. And those of you who don't believe that the people from the Council on Foreign Relations control almost all of the major media, you really need to read the article by Richard Harwood, written in the Washington Post in October of 1993. You can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and ask for Richard Harwood's article. We'd be glad to send it to you. And he lays out how really the government is controlled and the media is controlled all by the same people. And he's writing in the Washington Post, of all places. So we hope that you will, of course, help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day on the Internet, now 4 hours every day with shortwave and on news stations across America starting next week. And then, of course, we ask you to tell others about our website at RadioLiberty.com. Seriously consider getting the videos that we have. Let me suggest my video, The Brotherhood of Darkness, Iraq, The Untold Story, which explains to you how all of the wars of the last century, including Vietnam and Korea, were phony wars. The incident, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, didn't take place. The Spanish did not sink the Maine. The attack at Pearl Harbor was known long ahead of time, and the Japanese, and we actually have in our syllabus that comes with the video, if you request it, the article out of the Chicago Tribune showing that the Japanese had been trying to surrender for months, and we wouldn't let them. So the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the only two Christian cities in Japan, or partly Christianized cities, the invasion of Okinawa and of Iwo Jima, totally unnecessary. You'll actually see the article because we got it from the Chicago Tribune and so much other documentation. That's Iraq, The Untold Story. We hope you'll want to get our video, Diaprax, goes into the church growth movement that's sweeping America. Megiddo, the March Towards Armageddon, an excellent overview of what's going on, and the secret societies that created the wars of the last century, and the Third World War in which we're engaged today. That's Megiddo, the March to Armageddon. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, the December newsletter tells you why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools. And of course, lastly, we have encourage you to go to our website at www.radioliberty.com and urge other people to go there, to pull down our programs, to read the newsletters, to see the various items that we carry that help to finance our ministry. And then we hope that, of course, you'll pray for America, that you'll pray for revival, because I am firmly convinced that if the American people don't return to God, if there's not a great revival in this country, as happened with the first great revival in 1740 and the second great revival in the 1830s, then the America as we know it will cease to exist. And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this battle and we need your prayers. And so until tomorrow at the same time, when we'll be with you once again, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.